We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for March 14th, 2023. Today, we welcome Kevin Lasser, who's sitting in for TIATech USA's Susie Vestovich. Kevin has an important message about getting paid and the role of medical notes to ensure complete and accurate payment. We'll get the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her talkback segment. Now, hosting our program today is Dr. Erica Reamer.
Thank you, Clark Anthony, and I'm very sad that I didn't get one of those fun introductions that Chuck usually gets, but I'll try to make do anyway. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 545th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Today, we have our usual suspects, Tim Powell, Lori Johnson, Tiffany Ferguson, and we have Kevin Lasser sitting in for Susie Vestovich. Kevin will be talking about money, always a compelling topic. And then I will do my talk back about a topic from the ICD-10 Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. We have much news to report, and we begin with Tim Powell, who is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Thank you very much, and my question for the day is, CMS data, is it for sale? Medicare officially allows for-profit companies to use Medicare claims data under the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act of 2015, or MACRA. ResDAC allows companies to sign in as innovators for huge setup fees of up to $60,000 a year, and companies, including the major CPAs and consulting firms that I have participated with, have signed up for the data that will only use the data for research. So under Section 105 of MACRA, effective July 1st of 2016, qualified entries will be allowed to use the combined data and information derived from evaluations under Section 1874E of the Act to conduct non-public analysis and provide and sell these analyses to authorized users for public data in accordance with program requirements and other applicable laws. So in addition, qualified entities will be permitted to provide and sell the combined data or provide the Medicare claims data alone at no cost, again, in order in accordance with program requirements and other applicable laws to providers and suppliers and hospital associations and medical societies. Rather than the staggering agreement innovators face with ResDAC, users of the data will have to sign a business associates agreement with CMS. The government has some fairly schizophrenic data policies. The fact that Medicare provides physician and other Part B summary claims to the public but charges for ResDAC data for similar amounts seems to strain logic. Should a facility have privacy rights the physicians do not, why is it okay pulling physician Medicare payment data because it is in the public domain and have to worry about HIPAA for hospital data? I'm also confused that Medicare will provide data that they state has been stripped of HIPAA components and then requires providers to sign a business associates agreement about what they're going to do with the data. So here are my fearless thoughts. I think the data, including claims data, is going to become increasingly valuable, and we're going to need to sort out who gets what and what the government can charge for that data. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert and the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. It is Tuesday. It's March 14th, and you're listening to the 545th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
When your facility is faced with tight budgets, the folks at MedLearn are here to help with the MedLearn Media Resource Center. With the MedLearn Media Resource, you can keep your team trained and in the know with this web-based platform. It's created to help you make an impact on your revenue without breaking the bank, so that you can focus on what matters most, patient outcomes. Now, for a single low annual subscription, all your teams will have convenient one-stop access to the complete libraries of three trusted brands, MedLearn Publishing, ICD-10 Monitor, and Rack Monitor. One low monthly cost, unlimited access, and all the CEUs you need. It's the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Increase your knowledge with workable coding solutions and actionable answers so you can put the focus back on patient care with the MedLearn Media Resource Center.
Now's the time for the Talk 10 Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica. And hello to our listeners. The March Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting is over. The recordings for both days have been posted on the CMS website. Additionally, the question and answer document for procedures has been published. There were 22 topics on the final procedure agenda, as well as 9 therapeutic agent proposals that were not reviewed during the procedure presentation. 20 proposals requested new technology add-on payment status, or NTAP, for fiscal year 24. One intends to request NTAP status for fiscal year 25, and one intends to apply for NTAP status for fiscal year 26. The slides have also been published. There were 32 topics for diagnosis, and the addenda was on the agenda for diagnosis as well. The deadline for receipt of public comments on October 1st, 2023, proposed new codes and revisions that were discussed is April 7th, 2023. The deadline for receipt of public comments for new procedure codes and revisions effective April 1st, 2024 is May 5th, 2023, which is also the deadline for comments on new and revised diagnosis codes effective October 1st, 2024. You can send your comments to ICD procedure code request at cms.hhs.gov and the diagnosis comments to nchsicd10cm at cdc.gov. The fiscal year 24 codes effective on October 1st, 2023 will be published in the May-June timeframe. The deadline for submitting a proposal for the September 12th and 13th Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting is June 9th, 2023. The proposal should include the desire for consideration for April 1st, 2024 or October 1st, 2024 implementation date. The procedure proposals must be submitted through MERIS, which is the Medicare Electronic Application Request Information System. Diagnosis proposals may be emailed to nchsicd10cm at cdc.gov. One way to keep current on all the activities of the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting is to sign up for the subscriber list. And I will put that email address in my upcoming article. And Erica, I know that you were very busy during Coordination and Maintenance Committee. I hope you survived the 2 days.
Thank you, Lori. Yes, it was very fun. If you out there have not participated, I strongly recommend checking it out. It's really quite gratifying. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is Senior Healthcare Consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and thank you again, Lori Johnson. Coming up next, Tiffany Ferguson with a uniquely different topic.
This segment is sponsored by Erica Reamer, MD, creator of the Dr. Reamer's documentation modules, concise and easy-to-learn information, so your providers can improve their clinical documentation on demand. Now available at the ICD University Bookstore.
Here now is Tiffany Ferguson, who is pivoting to the appeals process today. Tiffany also has a Tucked In Tuesday listener survey. And good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, all, and good morning, Chuck. As mentioned, today I would like to pivot and discuss the appealing process. And the reason is I thought it would be a great poll for the audience. So it's a common occurrence in working with clients from our firm to be asked, what is the benchmark for? And in this and for today, what's the benchmark or metric that they pick typically related to denials? So I always reply with, the benchmark is based on your organizational reporting and can vary by internal practices and definition interpretations. The Healthcare Financial Management Association, HFMA, Claim Integrity Task Force has made significant strides to address this variation by providing standardized definitions and calculations for denials. However, I think the variation resides in the decisions that occur among the frontline employees, which creates some subjectivity for what is defined as a true denial and in the metric of the denial and appeal rate. Although there are likely more categories, one is the internal confusion of how the denial is categorized The next is the internal health care organization decision that are made by the appeal representatives when they decide what should be written off, how it is categorized, and what should be appealed. So for today's segment, I'm going to focus on the latter. However, my article out this week will cover both in collaboration with Denise Wilson from the Association of Healthcare Denial and Appeal Management, ADEM. The process for that they offer recommends a simple question. What is the likelihood of overturning the denial on appeal? They suggest an internal tracking mechanism called an appealability score. Although the tool is slightly subjective, what it forces the appealer to say is, based on the review of this case, guidelines for the for evaluation, and the documentation, what is the likelihood that this denial will be overturned if I actually appeal it? By asking this question and applying a score, the denials are placed into two categories: internal opportunities for the organization and external opportunities with the payer. This score is then documented on review and tracked in the denial metrics data against key performance indicators. So, for example, by applying this mechanism, cases that were still denied by the payer with a high appealability or winnability score could then be aggregated and provide a justifiable case to discuss to the payer, knowing full well these are the ones I need to fight, basically, until as far as I need to go. They can be used in joint payer-hospital joint meetings and even submit for arbitration. The appealability score criteria may be made as payer should be made as payer agnostic as possible so that fair comparisons can be made across the payers. Organizations that apply an appealability score will likely have a higher win rate on their appeals because they internally made a decision on what they knew was worth fighting and what they decided not to appeal. This is compared to other hospitals that then have decided, when you think of benchmarking, fight everything, knowing full well that they will not win them all. The concern with this effort is that the amount of internal people and the time it takes to fight claims where the payer will likely have was likely justified for not paying the hospital, and it lacks an opportunity to internally create a structure for denials prevention. If the healthcare organization instead decides to identify their low appealability cases for internal review, they can subcategorize these by accountability owners and reasons to create improved processes to prevent the denials from even occurring. For today's listener survey, I ask, what is your healthcare organization's approach to fighting denials? We fight everything. We internally decide what we are going to appeal. We do not have a process to appeal, no clue, and does not apply. And with that, back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Tiffany. I actually think that this is a great topic. I think it's a really interesting concept to do a appealability score. I used to do it myself when I was a physician advisor. I would make sure that, like, I wasn't wasting my time fighting ones that I knew were, you know, complete losses. It was just a loan, and I gave the money back. That was Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany is the CEO for Phoenix Medical Management. Chuck?
Thank you both, and we'll have the results of the day's Talked Into the Listener Survey later in this broadcast. But first, this very important message.
What do you do when CMS unloads barrels and barrels of new codes into your lap like fallen leaves? How do you stay on top of your game as a coding genius? Here's what you do. You subscribe to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal. For an unbelievably low subscription price, you have access to the superstars of coding, Gloria Ann Bryant, Laurie Johnson, and Dr. Erica Reamer. You'll have access to more than 40 educational webcasts, plus you'll earn CEUs to maintain your credentials. The retail value? More than $5,960. But for a limited time, your subscription is only $35 per webcast, a savings of 75%.
this morning we're talking about money, essentially getting paid the correct amount because, well, that's first and foremost with providers. Sitting in this morning for Susie Vestovich, who is the Chief Operations Officer for Teatech. It's the founder and CEO for RevKeep, Kevin Lasser. Good morning, Kevin. It's really all about the money, is that right?
Chuck, you are right. So what's the deal with medical notes? Why are notes so important? And why are they so difficult for providers to complete? As we all know, medical notes are an essential part of the RCM process. The information is used to ensure accurate billing and reimbursement for services that have been rendered. The revenue cycle process can be hindered without accurate medical notes, resulting in lost revenue. The cost of poor note-taking can be high, and it is not just isolated to lost revenue for a practice. Inaccurate medical notes have a stunningly negative effect on healthcare, creating longer hospital stays, higher healthcare costs, and a loss, up to 20% of revenue for providers. These facts are backed by well-known and respected studies conducted by the Journal of General Internal Medicine and the American Health Information Management Association, more commonly known as AHIMA. As if that is not enough, poor note-taking can also lead to errors in patient care, such as incorrect medication dosages and misdiagnoses. This not only results in additional medical expenses, but increased risk of malpractice lawsuits and patient harm. We are hearing from more and more of our clients regarding the difficulty in taking accurate and timely notes. This is of no surprise, as there have been a great amount of pressure as healthcare is experiencing a significant decrease in staffing and profits. The top two hurdles preventing the completion of notes that we hear about are the following. Number one, physicians fall behind with high patient volumes. Common daily patient tracking methods include spreadsheets or notes on pieces of paper. Paper is often set aside and forgotten in a stack of other paper. Excel spreadsheets seem to be the next step up, but is it really a step up? Figures in an Excel spreadsheet are often isolated and take a much higher technical skill to format into a usable data. Additionally, many physicians have multiple offices that operate as silos. So what we ultimately see are several stacks of paper in multiple offices. This just amplifies the problem. Number two, incomplete or non-attested notes are becoming much more common. Sometimes it comes down to a need for oversight. The clinical informatics team auditing a university specialty department found that one of its physicians did not sign over 3,000 notes. Depending on whether any of those encounters were still submissible at the point of discovery, the potential revenue loss was $300,000, and that's just for one physician. The more physicians to track, the more patient notes are at risk of being left behind. It gets complex quickly. With more and more patients coming in daily, detailing notes, which we know is a necessity, becomes a lesser priority. I have said this before, and I am certain you agree. Physicians went to medical school to help heal people, not necessarily document extensive amounts of information for the purpose of revenue cycle management. With so much at risk, ranging from proper care to a financial loss, what does one do? Well, the great news is that there are some wonderful technologies that have been designed specifically for these issues. The technology is proven and has a very easy to summarize ROI, which is a return on investment. Not only does it save time, but even better, patient care is enhanced and the practice makes more money. So Chuck, I live 20 minutes from the plant that rolled off the first Ford Model T. It is well known that when that first horseless buggy rolled off the line, there were many naysayers. They were comfortable riding horses. Folks, get off paper, horses, and jump on the technology of today, cars. Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Kevin. I just would like to take a little umbrage at the documentation for revenue cycle management. Erica Reamer personally believes that documentation is for quality of care and for demonstrating that you've you've provided that excellent quality of care, and the fact that you get reimbursed is just sort of a welcomed and intended consequence. That was Kevin Lasser. Kevin is the founder and CEO for RevKeep. Thank you. Back to you, Chuck.
Here now with the results of today's Marketing Tuesday survey is Tiffany Ferguson. Tiffany.
Good morning, all. So what I had asked is, what is your healthcare organization's approach to fighting denials? And there's a lot of movement coming in. What I found is we have about 13% said we fight everything. And about 61% said actually you have an internal process that you decide how you're going to appeal or what you're going to appeal. About 2% said we do not have a process to appeal.
Now's the time for our very popular segment here at Talk to Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Good morning, Dr. Reamer. It's all yours.
Thank you, Chuck. And I forgot to say earlier to everybody, Happy Pi Day 3.14. Okay, my talk back. I love the granularity of ICD-10-CM and being able to be very specific. You all know that. The Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting last week left me with a dilemma. Now that we have the technology to unravel the genetic basis for conditions, are we obligated to create unique codes for each variant? This is not the first time in the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meetings that we have encountered this problem, and it certainly won't be the last. The issue is that as we unravel the genetic basis for many disorders and conditions, should we be creating unique specific codes down to the genetic mutation? Different entities request new ICD-10-CM codes. Individuals, professional societies, drug or device companies, disease organizations. Frequently, family members of affected patients give impassioned pleas to create codes. These genetic conditions are often pretty rare, affecting a few people out of 100,000 live births. Why do interested parties want unique ICD-10-CM codes for specific conditions? It is hard to know how prevalent a condition is without being able to identify patients who have it, and prevalence guides resource allocation. Research, epidemiological studies, determining which therapies are effective, tracking, assessing outcomes like morbidity and mortality is made infinitely easier by having a unique ICD-10-CM code. Why not make a code for every single condition? Although there is the ability to make a lot of codes in ICD-10-CM, it is not unlimited. If you run out of characters, you can't just add another one. If you run out of E codes for metabolic disorders, you can't just roll over into F. I think the bigger barrier is getting folks to take advantage of the specificity. The researchers petitioning for the new codes would be eager to utilize them, but the average clinical practitioner might not. If we can't get providers to give us a specificity of malnutrition, what makes us think that we're going to be able to get them to tell us obesity due to disruption of MC4R pathway, nuclear receptor coactivator 1, NCOA1, gene mutation? For the genetic conditions presented at the meeting, they gave two options for new codes, if any were to be created. The first is very specific codes at the sub-category level, like for glutamate receptor-related neurodevelopmental disorders, code F84.831, GRIN2A, related neurodevelopmental disorder. The second choice was to add multiple specific codes at Z15, genetic susceptibility to disease, like Z15.121, genetic susceptibility to epilepsy and neurodevelopmental disorders related to pathogenic variety of GRIN2A gene. Humans have about 25,000 genes, and each gene can have hundreds to millions of DNA base pairs. So we have about 3 billion base pairs. That's the potential for a lot of genetic mutation havoc. I think the National Center for Health Statistics, NCHS, needs to decide their philosophical approach and go with it. Do the diseases need to have a threshold of incidence or prevalence? Is how serious the condition a factor? How resource intensive is it to manage the condition? Is the issue the manifestation of the genetic abnormality or the genetic mutation itself? And just having the mutation may not always mean that you have the disorder. Some diseases have variable expression, and some take time to develop the condition. I think it may take at least two codes to detail it, the pathological condition and the genetic disruption which caused it. You can have a genetic susceptibility code prior to developing condition. If the patient has other manifestations, like autism epilepsy, they should be additional codes to provide those details. I'm not really sure I have the answer to this. If you have your own opinions or ideas, review the topic packet and or watch the recording and send your comments to the NCHS part of the CDC, who administers ICD-10-CM. See how fun it is to be part of the process. Make your voice heard.
Now let's take a look at some of the questions and comments that are coming in since we've been on the air. Erica?
Okay. Well, Peter asked Tim, how can I learn more about CMS authorized data usage?
Lucky that you have that question, because right now we're working with the folks at Talk 10 Tuesday to put out a book on how to get more information about authorized data usage. So stay tuned. And I think that we're going to be able to provide something more global that will tell you all of the different sources that you might use for CMS authorized data and how to get it and how to use it.
Thanks, Tim. And our friend Ron Hirsch said that Tiffany's article this week is about SDOH and not appeals. Where is the article about appeals she mentioned? And I must also tell you that sometimes this week for me as well, I gave Chuck my article a little bit tardy, so mine actually will follow my talk back as well. So I'm presuming that Tiffany's article will be placed in the ICD-10 monitor imminently. I think that that's about all the time we have, Chuck, so I'm going to turn it back to you.
Thanks very much, Erica, and that is going to be a wrap for this live edition of Tucked In Tuesday, and I thank you very much for being with us today, and a special thanks to our panelists, Tiffany Ferguson, Laurie Johnson, Tim Powell, Kevin Lasser, who was sitting in today for Susie Besovich from TIATech USA, and Erica, very special thanks to you. And remember, when you can't listen to us live, you can listen to all of Talk to Tuesday broadcast on Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. And when you do, give us a review. Until next week, I'm Chuck Buck reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk to Tuesday. Thank you again, everybody, and have a great week.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.